Good morning. It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. Welcome to All Things Political for Monday, August 23rd, 2012. This week, we're going to focus on the political economy and the politics of the economy. Both candidates have focused much of their attention on the economy, mostly on how the other guy would be bad for it. And campaign spending, the political economy is also in the news. Oh, and taxes. There's always something about taxes and jobs. That's another hot topic. Well, my guest this morning is Bob Lowry, professor and head of the political science program in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Good morning, Professor Lowry, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, the economy, as would surprise no one, continues to be the number one issue in the presidential campaign, and each side has taken a different approach. Again, no surprises there. So let's talk about that first, starting with President Obama's campaign and its attacks on Mitt Romney's tenure at Bain Capital. The tenor of those has been, well, it's been pretty forthright, I guess would be one way to describe it, a pretty straight up, this is what happened and this was bad and he needs to own it. How successful do you think that strategy is going to be? And talk a little bit about the response from the Mitt Romney camp.
Well, I guess in the polls and so forth seem to indicate there's some, that it's been fairly successful in the short run, although, again, the national polls aren't really moving a lot. It's mostly, it seems, more like the pundits and, you know, the professional politicians who are seem to be saying that Obama's making some headway here. Romney hasn't really responded a lot. In fact, he's been getting a fair amount of criticism for not being more proactive and for letting Obama sort of define him to some extent. I mean, he came out with a story that said, well, I wasn't really in charge from 1999 to 2002, and that's about it. I mean, it seems to me that the question here really is just how relevant is all of this? I mean, it was a private equity firm. They were supposed to make money for their clients. Does that necessarily mean what it's supposed to predict his trade policy 2 years from now or something? Although, on the other hand, part of the problem is that Romney has held that out as his number one qualification to be president. And so the Obama campaign is essentially saying, well, okay, if that's your number one qualification, let's look at it.
Well, you know, that really is what it boils down to, because he's not been running on his track record as governor of Massachusetts. In fact, for pretty much all of the Republican primaries, he ran as far away from that as he could get. And that really leaves him with Bain Capital. And now some are suggesting he's running away from that, too. Doesn't leave much of a resume.
Not really. I mean, he hasn't said much about his time as governor, partly because I think he wants to sort of stay away from the whole health care issue. And the Obama campaign hasn't focused much on that either. And, of course, the other piece of his resume that nobody has said anything about was running the Salt Lake Olympics, which allegedly he was very, very good at and might, you know, involve more the kinds of political skills you would need as president than running a private equity firm.
But, yeah, why do you think that is? Why hasn't that been a bigger part of the campaign?
I really don't know why Romney hasn't tried to make more of that. I mean, he seems to be playing, you know, this game of, well, as long as the economy stays bad, I just don't want to say anything that might give anybody some ammunition. But I don't know what there would be about Salt Lake that would get anybody any ammunition.
Well, there are complaints from people, insiders in the Republican Party, that Governor Romney has really failed to clearly identify himself or to present a clear picture of who he is. We're not seeing any kind of bio or character campaign ads or anything like that, except for a few that one of the super PACs ran in a limited number of markets. He is not making a whole lot of attempt to define himself as a candidate right now, which basically leaves it wide open for the Obama campaign to do the defining for him. That seems kind of like a dangerous strategy.
It does. And I mean, yeah, it's sort of the conventional wisdom of campaigns is you don't want to let your opponent define you. I mean, you want to get out and define yourself and define your program. And if you can, you want to define your opponent. And he's not doing that, unless it's essentially a matter of timing. He figures, you know, it's the middle of the summer. Most people aren't paying a whole lot of attention. He has been raising a great deal of money, and maybe he's planning on really, you know, once the convention's over, really, you know, going on the air with a huge campaign. But it seems like a pretty risky strategy at this point.
Well, the Obama campaign, meanwhile, is spending a lot of money right now. In fact, that has some Democratic insiders worried that the president will have enough money when the real campaign starts after the conventions are over. How do you see that playing out?
Well, yeah. I mean, Obama is, of course, in 2008, just raised an astonishing amount of money. And actually, I'm not sure how the raw numbers compare, but he's been raising a lot this year as well, but he's also been spending a great deal. In fact, I think in the last month, he spent more than he raised. And the last couple of months, Romney has raised more than Obama. And then there are the super PACs, which tend to be more heavily on the Republican side. So overall, I mean, Obama is looking at the possibility of being outspent, which would be, you know, pretty unusual at the presidential level for the incumbent to be outspent. I'm not really sure how much difference it's going to make, because everybody knows so much about the presidential candidates anyway, especially the incumbent. You know, and the academic research on campaign spending says it matters in, for example, congressional races, especially for the challengers who need to get name recognition. But at the presidential level, an extra $100,000 or even an extra $1 million, you wonder just how much difference it'll make.
Well, I guess we'll find out. The Romney campaign has tried to portray President Obama as a failure in terms of his management of the economy, the fact that we haven't recovered from this recession yet and there are still so many people without work. This is a result of the failed policies of the Democrats in general and President Obama specifically. Obviously, the truth is a lot more complicated than that, but is this a charge that they can make stick?
Well, yeah. I mean, regardless of the truth, I mean, it's just a fact that presidents get more credit or blame for the macroeconomy than they deserve, because they're the ones in charge. I mean, the one sort of specific attack that Romney seems to be making is to exactly what, you know, Obama has done wrong is all these arguments about uncertainty between, especially again, focusing on health care. And then just in general, the possibility of, you know, regulations, things like Dodd-Frank and that sort of thing. And that does, you know, create a climate that makes it difficult for people to know whether they should invest. You know, there's all these reports about private corporations now are sitting on just a tremendous amount of cash. And the Romney campaign is going to argue that that's Obama's fault because of uncertainty. And it's really hard to disprove a claim like that.
Well, I guess the response to that is that the reason that they're sitting on all that cash is that there's no demand, and that they can more profitably invest that money by just swapping it back and forth with one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean Paul Krugman, you know, Nobel Prize winning economist, has been arguing for a long time that the problem with Obama's policy is it wasn't enough, that the stimulus should have been twice as big.
Well, let's go to that for just a moment, because maybe my memory is getting worse than I thought, but I thought the original amount of the stimulus proposed in Congress was twice that they didn't actually spend all of the money that they were supposed to begin with.
Boy, I'd have to go do some homework on that, too. But
okay. Well, I'm probably wrong.
That they didn't spend all of it. What I'm not sure about is whether Congress allocated it and then the state didn't spend it.
I think there was more money allocated than actually got spent. And
right.
Actually, some of the money is still coming through in the form of highway projects and so forth, things like that. What's interesting, I guess, to some is that in spite of the fact that the economy seems to be getting worse again, President Obama is still leading in most national polls. How do you account for that?
Well, maybe part of it is just what we've been talking about, that that Romney hasn't really made a real strong case for himself personally. People do seem to like President Obama, and that certainly counts for something. And again, Romney hasn't, other than saying the economy's bad and I used to be a very successful businessman, hasn't done a whole lot to explain what he would do differently. I mean, he talks about, you know, keep taxes low and regulations low. Okay, that's not very specific. And taxes are already at very low levels compared to 20 years ago, say. So, you know, he really hasn't made a real strong case for himself.
Well, they're quite a bit lower than they were under President Reagan. That's something we do know.
Yes.
And some economists are saying, well, you know, at this point, cutting taxes again isn't really going to achieve very much because taxes are already so low that it doesn't really matter. Well, I want to hold off on the tax thing for just a moment and try and get some of our listeners involved in this discussion. We're talking today about, well, it's all things political. It's political news. But we're kind of looking at this from the standpoint of how the two campaigns are talking about the economy and then something called the political economy and all of the campaign spending and so forth. That's all fodder for discussion. What do you think about the various tax proposals being bandied about by the two candidates and by their parties and surrogates and so forth? What about Mr. Romney's tax returns? He says, submitted what is required by law, and he's not going to do anymore. And his wife says, you people have to quit asking. I don't know what she means by you people, and that sort of was blown up in the blogosphere, of course. But there's been a tremendous amount of resistance from the Romney camp to releasing any more tax information than is required by the law. And even GOP governors are asking Mr. Romney to release more tax returns. We'll talk about that as well. Anyway, here's how you get in touch. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave a comment there as well. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have some callers who want to join us. You could be one of them. Again, that number, 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 20 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Rob Ferret is in for Ben Marins today. And after three, only one-third of Americans can name all three branches of government. In the 3 o'clock hour, Rob Ferret and his guests discuss the civics gap in our country. What can be done to turn students into engaged citizens? Boy, that's kind of a scary statistic. That's after 3 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political. And my guest this morning is Bob Lowry, professor and head of the political science program in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. We have callers who want to join us, professor, so let's go to the phones, and we'll start in Milwaukee with Adam. Adam, good morning.
Good morning. My degree just happens to be in economics, and I just can't let this comment go by made by Professor Krugman that we need more stimulus. I mean, he is just not leveling with the American public on this. The so-called stimulus of President Obama was merely payback for political friends of the Democrat Party, like the UAW and the Teachers Union, for instance. It was a paltry $800 billion. That gave cover to Obama's Fed chairman to create something like $16 trillion in brand new money. That's something like 30 times the amount of the Obama so-called stimulus. I mean, is Professor Krugman suggesting that 30 times that $800 billion is not enough of a stimulus. Maybe we should do 50 times that amount. Where is this money going to come from?
Well, that opens up a whole other discussion about monetary policy, but the Fed did create a lot of money. It went to the banks, and they basically invested it. But what are they invested in sounded, from the news reports, mostly in more paper.
Yes, and I think that, I don't want to channel Paul Krugman, but I mean, I think he would say that given the choice between a fiscal spending stimulus and monetary policy, especially given that interest rates are already, you know, at rock bottom levels, he'd rather see it, the policy focus on fiscal spending as being more effective. And it really matters, you know, who you give the money to and what they do with it.
Well, let's make a distinction here between monetary policy and the fiscal spending policies of the government, because when the Fed can create as much money as it wants. I mean, these days money is sort of almost a fictional concept in and of itself. It's sort of imaginary. There isn't anything really behind it except the full faith and credit of the Treasury of the United States government. But the Fed can create all the money it wants. It doesn't have to ask Congress or the president, and it determines what the monetary policy of the country is, and the president and the Congress are the ones dealing with spending and taxation issues.
Exactly. I mean, the Fed is, by design, one of the more independent central banks in the world, and is set up so that they are not subject to political manipulation. I think, you know, really does try to operate autonomously. So really, I mean, that as far as the president and Congress goes, pretty much all they can do is fiscal policy, taxing, and spending. And then the Fed acts on its own to determine what else, you know, might be needed. But that I think that sort of goes to the caller's comment about stimulus providing cover for what the Fed did. I mean, I don't think those were really coordinated.
All right, Adam, thanks for the call. Let's go to Rich next in Appleton. Rich, good morning. Thanks for being on the Kathleen Dunn program.
Well, thank you very much. And you don't sound like Kathleen at all, by the way. What I'd like to say is I feel a little bit that Obama has been kind of put down by the Republicans in every turn, and I just don't see a fair shake here for him as far as what he was able to accomplish without looking at the fact that every time he opened his mouth, the Republicans were trying to shut him down. I mean, how do you accomplish anything under those conditions? And in that state, he actually got the healthcare issue at least pushed forward to some degree, even if it's not a perfect system. So he did make some kind of a change, which I think is huge. So I'm just thinking that he's being beat up on every turn, and I just wondered how it's going to, you know, wash out if he ever gets back to where he can have the power again.
Well, you start out with Mitch McConnell saying our whole purpose in being here is to make sure President Obama doesn't get a second term. That kind of set the tone for what came next. What about what Rich has to say, Professor?
Yeah, I think he makes a very good point. And McConnell sort of, you know, committed the classic definition of a Washington, D.C. gaffe, which is he said what everybody knows to be true, but nobody ever says. And that's that the opposition is, you know, focused on the next election to a great deal. But certainly since the midterms, you know, now that the Republicans control the House and are able to filibuster in the Senate, the president really can't do anything on his own, or the Democrats can't do anything on their own. I mean, the one criticism, again, some people on the Democratic side have made is they suggested that Obama should have tried to do more on the economy in the first 2 years rather than focusing on health care, that you know, he should have just put that off and focused more on trying to get the economy in shape first.
Well, let's see. Oh, we ran out of callers. We just lost one. And I want to give the number again to remind people of where to call to be part of All Things Political here on the Kathleen Dunn program. 800 800-486-8655. Almost forgot where I was there for a second. 800-486-8655. You can send us an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And the Kathleen Dunn Program has a Facebook presence. You can go there and leave a comment or a question. The Obama's administration's efforts to deal with economic issues and health care and so forth, obviously opposed by the GOP, which you would expect. I mean, no big surprise there. But the going back to the health care question, you mentioned it, that some had said, well, he should have spent more time on the economy in the first 2 years. It seemed to some people that they could have gotten the health care law passed a lot quicker had the president not been so interested in trying to compromise with Republicans and give them something they could support. They ended up not supporting it anyway, even though it was their own plan. Was that a big political mistake that the Obama administration made early on?
I think it's one of those things where you can say in hindsight it was, because of what we know about how things worked. I'm not sure you can really blame him for not trying to do it the way he did. I mean, you're right. It was Max Baucus who had this Senate committee that went on for months and months trying to get some sort of a bipartisan proposal, and they never did. But what I mean by saying I don't know if you can blame him in hindsight is, remember, Obama ran on this platform that he was going to break through the partisanship, and he was going to reach out to both, you know, to the other side, and we're not Democrats and Republicans, we're all Americans. And so if he had taken his first big legislative initiative and just rammed it right through on a straight party line vote, that would have been pretty inconsistent with the whole way he tried to run his campaign. So, like I said, you can see why he did it the way he did it, but in hindsight, given that in the end it was a straight party, you know, deal, he certainly could have gotten what he got quicker.
They ended up having to use the reconciliation parliamentary maneuver in the Senate anyway.
Right.
They could have just as well have done that in March as to have waited as long as they did, and it ended up being a huge factor in the midterm elections.
Right.
So 2020 hindsight is, it's all 2020. I guess that's why they call it that. We're getting some more calls. If you get a busy signal when you call in, send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or leave a comment on Facebook. Let's talk about tax returns. One of the criticisms of Governor Romney is that he's not been forthcoming about his past income tax returns, and just about everybody outside of the immediate Romney camp, including a lot of prominent Republicans, have been asking him to be more forthcoming about his finances. He's refused. Does this not create the impression, fair or not, I'm not suggesting that this is fair, that he has something to hide?
Well, I think it does. And, yeah, I'm not sure it's fair either. To some extent, it's similar to the Bain issue. You sort of wonder, you know, just how relevant it really is to how he might be as president in the future. But nonetheless, I mean, there's sort of this tradition which goes back, especially to his father, George Romney, when he ran for president, that, you know, candidates typically release several years of returns. There are reports that when he was being vetted in 2008 by the McCain campaign, he gave them 20-some years, 23 years, I think, of returns. And yet he's only willing to release one, and he says he's going to release one more, the 2011 returns now. And so people sort of wonder why. You know, what is he hiding? And the only real answer he's given is basically that he doesn't want to provide people hundreds or thousands of pages that they can go through and pull something out of context and try to make an issue out of.
The issue's been made. Whether he reveals them or not, it'll be an issue either way. And some have said, well, at least this way you can kind of control the news cycle a little bit. But I don't know. It's all it's all enough to give the average person a really big headache. A new report says that poverty in the United States is on track to rise to its highest level since the 1960s. The study also suggests that suburban poverty is on the rise, and a lot of people who were once a part of the upper middle class are now really struggling to get by working part-time if they can find any work at all. Joblessness certainly is not something that's going to create a lot of goodwill for a sitting president. What does this study suggest to you about how the rest of the campaign is likely to go? Is this going to have any impact or not? Or have we stopped caring about the poor?
No, and that's actually exactly my point that I want to make. And it ties to what you just said about poverty being up in suburbia and people who at one point, you know, three, even 5 years ago, seemed to have a very comfortable life. I think the really relevant number is not so much what the percentage of people unemployed or in poverty is. It's the percentage of people who are worried about the possibility that they might become unemployed or impoverished. And given, you know, things like the trends in suburbia, you know, people who lost their homes and had them foreclosed and now are really struggling, I don't know what that actual number is, but I think it's a lot higher than the actual poverty rate. And, you know, that's a real problem. Because politically, I mean, if the impoverished are sort of segmented off, I mean, this is, you know, this isn't saying anything good for people who are in poverty, but if they're sort of, you know, the same people and it's not a majority of voters that are really worried about something that might happen to them, you know, it's maybe not a huge political issue. But when it becomes something that people think they or their neighbor or somebody in their family, you know, might run into and they're worried, then that I think has more of a political impact.
All right, let's take a couple of more phone calls. We'll take a couple of calls here on the health care policy issue and how that relates to the economy and the election. And we'll start in Madison with Mike. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. So a quick comment on the health care issue and how that relates to our current economy. I see it as very simply, I'm glad the president decided to go ahead and make an attempt at fixing our health care system. I personally know that my brother-in-law and my sister spend currently three-quarters of their income on their health insurance. They do not have health insurance provided by either one of their employers, and they have two kids that were born through hospital error with birth defects. And unfortunately, there's pre-existing conditions, and they spend a lot of money. In a similar situation for myself, I currently pay more than my rent for my health care. And my employer pays 50% of my health care. I couldn't imagine if I ever had to, well, I know for a fact before I had this job, I'd never had health care because I could not afford it. So I think that's a fairly large economic issue. We had all this extra money to be spending on other things besides our health care. And as another prime example, my friend just had emergency surgery to save his life, and he doesn't have any health insurance, and he's looking at a $100,000 bill right now. And that was for the first part of the surgery, and I had put a colostomy bag in him. And in order for him to get this colostomy bag removed, they're calling it an elective surgery, and he's looking at another $120,000 to have them finish what they started. I just think that, you know, he's never going to be able to buy a house. He's never going to qualify for any types of loans because he's going to have this insane medical debt. And had he had the option to spend this money on other things, it would help boost the economy. And everyone knows our medical system is not up to par in comparison to the rest of the world currently.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. I want to go to Deborah in Gray Lake, Illinois next and hear what she has to say. And then, Professor, I'll have you comment on both at once. Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I wanted to point out that you can't do anything about the economy without doing something about health care because the government pays for Medicaid, Medicare, VA benefits, and also the uninsured. So we're paying 60 to 65% of all of the health care costs in this country through taxpayer revenue anyway. So if, you know, you might as well have a single payer system if you're going to pay that kind of premium anyway. So I think the government already is paying for health care, and if they didn't reform it, they couldn't do anything about the economy. Thanks.
Healthcare directly related to the economy, Professor, people having to spend so much on their premiums that they can't buy anything else, or just the fact that the government already spends a considerable amount having an effect on the economy. What about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there is a connection. As the first caller mentioned, I mean, if you don't have high-quality health insurance through your employer, I mean, either you can't get it at all if you have pre-existing conditions. I mean, this is prior to the recent Health Care Act. Or, you know, you have to pay exorbitant amounts, and actually that doesn't really change until next year, or 2014, excuse me, until the provisions really kick in. And so that obviously is going to affect those people who are affected. That obviously affects their overall financial situation. And the other really, I think, direct connection to the economy, and this, however, is a criticism of the plan they got through, is costs. I mean, health costs are just going up at such a high rate, and they're sucking up more and more resources that could be used for other things. But the plan that they got through really does not do very much. I mean, they talk about bending the cost curve. There are some provisions that are designed to try to alter some incentives and do that, but there's very little that really guarantees it'll have much of an effect on costs.
Well, some would argue that until we get away from the fee-for-service model of medical care, that we really don't have a chance to get costs under control, but that's probably a discussion for an entire hour, not the limited time we have here. Let's take another quick call before we go to a break. We'll go back to Milwaukee and hear from Jim next. Jim, good morning.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the jobs issue in terms of both looking at it from an illogical sense and a logical sense. In terms of illogical sense, a certain percentage of the Republican base would believe that the snake in the Garden of Eden was a Democrat if you told them that. And if you don't believe that, I just point out to people that during the 2008 campaign, McCain honestly said that Obama was a decent person and wasn't a Muslim. And recently, McCain attacked the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood trying to infiltrate us, and still the base ignores it. Now, in terms of logic, you can look at the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy. And in the self-fulfilling prophecy, you say, well, there's a problem out there, and if we don't do something about the problem, it's going to get worse. So then the Republicans go out and obstruct and deny any efforts to pass any legislation to deal with the jobs problem, and then they come back and piously say, you see, we told you so.
Jim, thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, yeah, I mean, that goes, I think, to the question we were talking about a little bit earlier about, especially since, you know, the 2010 elections, it's really just been a standoff in terms of anything legislatively. And I think sort of both parties are hoping that this upcoming election will clarify the situation enough so that one side or the other, obviously they both hope it will be them, is able to really take the reins and push through the kinds of policies they want to. I'm a little skeptical about that. I mean, especially with the rules in the Senate. I don't know if either party is going to get enough Senate seats to really do that.
Well, the Senate continues to be one of the more dysfunctional bodies on the planet, and unless one of the two parties can get that two-thirds majority, there is very little hope, according to most observers, that anything can happen in the Senate. I mean, it's rather absurd.
Well, yeah, and a lot of it just keeps coming back to the filibuster, which...
But they don't really even filibuster anymore.
They've always had the filibuster, but it used to be sort of by consensus. It was very rarely used.
But, I mean, they really did filibuster.
Right, and when they used it, they actually did. I mean, people would stand up and talk and read from the dictionary and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, now, you know, you don't get that anymore. So it's sort of this threat of the filibuster and, oh, okay, well, we can't go there. There was another story that came out yesterday about how the president's judicial appointments are in being held in limbo. And again, a minority in the Senate is able to block anything from happening and seems to think that this is perfectly good public policy. And no doubt if the Democrats were in the minority, they would be doing the same thing.
Exactly. You could change the rules of the Senate by a majority vote, but the reason they don't is they know that they might be in the minority next time.
Okay. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have some more calls. You could be one of them at 800-486-8655. If you get a busy signal, try email talk@WPR.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, next hour, imagine what's the longest hike you've ever taken? Now imagine hiking 1,500 miles around Lake Superior. We're going to talk to the authors of the book Going Full Circle, a 1,555-mile walk around the world's largest lake. I'll have Mike Link and Kate Crowley, who took on that trek, in the studio with me next hour. This hour, it's All Things Political. My guest is Bob Lowry, professor and head of the Political Science Program in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Now, Professor, before we go back to the phones, let's talk about taxes, because this is an area where the Republicans and the Democrats have some, have really sharp and very clear differences, because the and let's just use the Bush tax cuts as an example. The president now wants to keep the Bush tax cuts for the middle class, but end them, allow them to expire, which they will, I believe, what, in January, if they're not renewed again. He wants to allow them to expire for people who are above a certain income level. And, of course, the Republicans want all of the tax cuts to stay. In fact, they want to make more. So let's talk about tax policy as it affects the economy and where these two candidates are on taxes. This seems to me and to many others to be another high stakes game of chicken.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and in fact, they've been quite explicit about it. Patty Murray was one of the leading Democrats on this issue, came out and said, I think last week, that they're willing to let all the cuts expire if the Republicans block Obama's proposal. But basically, I mean, the Democrats, yeah, are saying that we need to raise, and part of the problem here is there's two big issues. There's the economy, the macroeconomy, and there's the debt. And in order to do something about the federal debt, we got to get more revenue. As we were saying before, the effective tax rate, which is simply tax revenues divided by the economic base, is low relative to what it was, you know, when Bill Clinton was president. Let alone Ronald Reagan. And so if you're going to close that gap, you've got to raise some money somewhere. Letting the cuts expire on only the wealthy won't raise nearly enough money, but it will raise some. But neither party really wants to raise rates on everybody because they're concerned about what that will do for the economy. The Democrats, or at least some of them, are now saying they're willing to let that happen, at least temporarily, if that's what it takes to get, you know, to get something, get what they want.
Yeah, there were, and there have been some dire warnings from economists about what would happen if all of the tax cuts expire at the same time that the government is cutting spending. That those two things together would really cause another big dip in the economy and possibly another recession. Maybe not as severe as the 2008, but pretty close to it.
Yes, I mean, I've seen some pretty dire predictions. I mean, what's scheduled to happen, the so-called fiscal cliff, is the Bush tax cuts are expiring, the payroll tax reduction is expiring, and the spending sequestration that was done as a result of the debate over the debt ceiling is supposed to take effect so that automatic cuts start rolling in all at the same time in January. Mm-hmm. And if all of that happens, that's a huge hit. Now, I don't know what happens if, for example, the Democrats let all the cuts expire just for a few months until they're able to get something else in place, but even that would create enormous uncertainty and a short-run hit for the economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I forget which columnist it was, but somebody said the train is headed for the cliff, and the engineers are arguing what color to paint the caboose.
Yeah, I mean, it really seems almost bizarre. And again, I think what both sides are secretly hoping is that they'll do well enough in the election that they can actually put through their proposals. But I'm just skeptical about whether that's going to happen.
Well, handicap this for me, based on what's going on with the economy and what we know about how spending affects congressional elections, is there any hope that the Democrats will retake the House of Representatives in the fall?
Oh, I don't follow congressional elections seat by seat closely enough, but I mean, I suppose there might be.
Well, I mean, we had a lot of Tea Party candidates get elected.
Right.
How are they going to fare when it's their turn to stand before the voters and they have a record?
Exactly. Freshman incumbents are the most vulnerable incumbents. So a lot of those seats probably are not real solid right now. So there certainly is a chance. And again, the Democratic candidates are in a little bit of a tough position. They probably don't want to be tied too closely to Obama's policies, at least on the economy. But again, I think really the argument they have to make is that, look, we've got to break the stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as, any sort of specific issues about their particular opponent. And I think there is a chance. But what I think is not likely to happen is that either party is going to get enough seats in the Senate to really control it.
Okay. Well, let's take a call, and we'll go to Clintonville next. Reed is on the phone. Reed, good morning.
Good morning. First, I would like to challenge you as the host as to what you said. You said the Democrats would do exactly what the Republicans would do, and that is patently false, inaccurate, untrue, and unbelievable. Secondly, in regard to what your guest has recently said concerning the fact that people want want taxes to either remain as they are or to remove taxes from the tax break from everyone. Poll after poll after poll has shown, and the Democrats support those polls, that the entire country, to the extent of like 65% to 72%, I believe it is, of people across the country want taxes to remain or be raised on the wealthy, and to remain as they are, or even be lowered for the middle class and lower classes. So those are my comments, and I would like to hear some responses. Thank you.
Reed, thanks for the comments, Professor. You don't have to comment on what he said about what I said, but what about the polling on the tax question?
Well, I think he's right about it. I mean, I didn't mean to suggest that the Democrats in Congress or anywhere else want all of the cuts to expire. They have basically, or at least some of them, have threatened this as basically a bargaining tactic, as saying, look, what we want to do is we want to let the cuts expire on the wealthy and keep them in place for everybody else. But if the Republicans aren't going to budge, we're willing to let them expire on everybody. And as you said, it becomes a big game of chicken. But I think he's right. The polls show that a clear majority would support basically what the Democrats are proposing, that they go up for the wealthy and remain the same, or maybe mm-hmm. even come down for everybody else.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, when you look at polling data, and just going back to the healthcare debate, if you look at the individual pieces of the Affordable Care Act, people say, "Oh, yeah, well, we like the no more pre-existing conditions and the individual pieces of it." But they when you take it as in aggregate, the image mm-hmm. of this thing, the so-called Obamacare is more negatively viewed. So I guess I'm just using that as a comment on polls in general. It's amazing what people will say in a poll, and then when they get in the voting booth, sometimes behavior doesn't match opinion. Let's try and get another call in here, and this time it'll be John in Appleton. John,
yes,
good morning.
Just tie this back to, government revenue and taxes, and I think there is a lot of suspicion about how Romney made his money in questions. I I mean, I think there might be a program idea here. How does something like Bain Capital manage to double the money of its investors every year?
Actually, we're going to talk about that tomorrow,
okay.
I think, at 10 o'clock, if
wonderful,
my producers
wonderful.
Can put up something. Nine o'clock tomorrow. We're going to talk about that at 9 tomorrow morning, is how these funds and these venture capitalist operations actually work and what they do. So 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, you can get your question answered.
Okay. Yeah, he has $100 million in an IRA. The rest of us, we can put in $6,000 a year, I think the limit is. I mean, how the rich work on a different set of rules, this seems to be the issue. And, you know, maybe you can sort of raise taxes on the rich, but if they put all their profits in the Cayman Islands, what good does that do?
Well, it's a question that I think has probably been put to Governor Romney. There have been questions raised about his offshore accounts and what that all means. Of course, it's perfectly legal to put money in foreign banks. There's no question about that, but it does have a negative appearance, perhaps. Professor?
Yeah, I mean, the one issue on the tax returns, I think, that really does jump out at me is this IRA account. I mean, it's valued at a very broad range. It's like 20 to 100 million. But even so, how do you accumulate $20 million even in an IRA account? Even though I guess the contribution limits for like partners and private partnerships, he can put more than $6,000 a year. But even so, just mathematically, how is that possible? And the other part, yeah, about having money in the Cayman Islands or a Swiss bank account, that's all perfectly legal. But politically, you know, for some people, it just looks bad. And that's really, I think, what it comes down to is they, you know, especially when we're talking about, you know, fairness in the international economy, and Mitt Romney's making all these arguments about the Chinese manipulating their currency and sort of working the system, and yet someone can look at his tax returns and say, well, isn't that sort of what you're doing on an individual level? So it just sort of politically, I think, is a bit of an issue, even if there's no real legal problem there.
Let's hear from Bruce in Wausau next. Bruce, go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning. You have a very interesting program. I've been over to Europe quite a few times on business over the years, and this is an analogy. It's not an accurate one, but say if you were to have open-heart surgery and you had 6 bypasses to have done to your heart, and in these particular countries, every one of them have been a failure, where the patient has died on the table. And in this country, at least they're partially successful. Why would you emulate the medical procedures in Europe that have been a total failure, and the ones here have been partial successes? And then another question. If we took all the money away from these people that are wealthy, how long could we drive our government or make it work? And thirdly, what would happen if in the federal, state, and county, and city governments, if there was a cut right across the board of, say, 8 or 10%, how would that affect all of this? And I'll take my comments off here.
All right, a lot to chew on there. I'm not certain that that all bypasses in Europe fail, but the point is, if medical care is better here than in Europe, why would we emulate their system? And you want to start there and try and get through this? We've only got about a minute left.
Okay. I think on medical care, as far as I know, it's true that if we're talking about the high-end, you know, technological cutting-edge, really difficult, really expensive procedures, you get better at the medical care here than anywhere else in the world. The problem with the U.S. system is that a lot of people don't have access to any care, and it isn't very good on sort of the low-end preventative type stuff. And so it's trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, you know, another word for trade-offs is rationing, which gets people very scared. But a lot of these other countries actually, you know, they have higher life expectancy than we do because they do a better job at the low-end stuff.
Okay, very quickly, because we've only got about a half a minute left, what about the third point that the caller made about what if we just cut all government spending by about 8 or 10% at the state and county and local level?
That would be... I'm not sure exactly what he would cut. Most of the state and county local level, an awful lot of that goes to either education or things like Medicaid, which is driven in part by federal requirements. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Texas, we're already like 49th or 50th on per capita state and local government spending. So I think it would really, really, you know, hurt things, basic services.
Okay, and we're going to have to leave it there, Professor,
because there's a lot of slack in most state and local government budgets now.
All right.
Not after the last 3 or 4 years.
We're out of time. Thank you so much, Professor Lowry, for spending this hour with us. It's been a lot of fun to talk with you.
Okay, glad to be here.
Bob Lowry is professor and political science program head of the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. Rhonda Fanning produced this program, and Brett Jaspers handled on-air production this morning. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's been All Things Political this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.